Hi, welcome to the Spotlight Report. I'm your host, Logan Graves. This is a monthly podcast where we dive into topics that pique our interest. They typically cover optics and science, but honestly, they can be quite broad. You can find out more about the Spotlight Report and find all of our episodes, as well as comment or like the podcast, on our new location, which is on the ELE Optics Community Forum. That location is community.eleoptics.com, and you'll find the Spotlight Report there. Thanks for listening.
So it started with, hi, this is a Spotlight Report?
Sure.
Okay.
So this week, my guest is Dr. Wayne Geerling, who got his PhD in economics from the University of Melbourne. Wayne and I met in Tucson, and this is kind of a new one for me because my background's optics and yours is economics. So I'm pretty excited to see where this goes. Before we get started, can you just kind of tell me how you got into economics to start with?
Yeah, no problems at all. Now, first of all, one slight correction, my PhD is actually in history. Now, it is at the University of Melbourne. I did study economics for 4 years and then I transferred to history. Now, in terms of where it all began, high school, 15, 16 year old, impressionable, had a fantastic economics teacher. I mean, I think that's where it often starts, right? That the great teachers you have at high school shape your life. You remember the very best and the very worst. So I remember Jane Alexander. I had her. Now, our system's a bit different in Australia. So year 11 and year 12 is pretty much like the final 2 years of senior high over here. And I did economics both years, loved it. Jane was such an awesome teacher. And I thought, great, I'll do economics. Now, must be honest, my first preference was law, but I wasn't good enough to get into law. So economics was pretty much second, third, fourth preference. So snapped it up. And yeah, so studied economics from there. Spent 4 years doing it, did a Bachelor of Economics, did an honors year. And then didn't really feel that that was the area I wanted to work in. So I moved into history, did a PhD in history, but came the full circle. My PhD is in German history. My supervisor was American at the University of Melbourne. And he came to visit me when I was in Berlin. And I said, what can I look forward to when I finish my PhD? And he said, unemployment. And I thought, maybe I'll go back into economics. So that's pretty much that. In about 1 minute, pretty much explains the detour and then the returning home. I was like a dog that came home up with its tail between its legs.
Well, I appreciate the bluntness of your advisor. We'll dive into this kind of more what your current research is on. But at least at the outset, did you like it? Did you like the shift, the curve back into economics?
I loved it. I mean, when I finished studying economics, I honestly didn't think I'd come back. And because history was always my love as a kid. And there's something with young men growing up and war, we just love it, right? So I got into World War I, World War II, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And in my spare time, I still listen to history podcasts. So I loved all that stuff. But when one door closes, another door opens. So I was fortunate in that I was trained in two different disciplines. And I actually did a little bit of history TA work and economics TA work during my PhD because I needed a bit of money. So I was able to keep a foot in both camps. And then when the history door closed, then, you know, economics opened up. And I started at the bottom. I was a TA. I had a 6-week contract to teach summer school. You know, that's always in high demand for academics, of course. So can't find anyone to teach it. So I stepped up and did international business environment. It was the first course I ever taught. And I had a 6-week contract, then a semester contract, then another semester contract, then a year contract, and then it got converted to tenure. So I was really fortunate. And I made my reputation back based on the fact that I could teach high volume, high intensity, lots of passion, and just enjoyed the work. And the students loved what I did. So I was able to parlay enthusiasm and passion for teaching into something pretty awesome.
And that's going to be really the focus of the first half of our discussion today is your approach to teaching economics. I do want to say, before we jump into that, I just recently read a biography about Douglas MacArthur.
Yeah.
You're speaking about, you know, kind of.
Very well known.
The appeal, right? And I had a brief moment of like, man, it would have been cool to really study this. And I thought, well, maybe the book is sufficient. So, but the focus of it, you know, I think you take potentially a pretty unique approach to how you teach economics. I guess why don't you introduce for the audience what it is that you do different?
Okay, so my view is that an instructor has to be able to connect with an audience. And I should preface that by saying I've been in this industry for nearly 20 years. I'd like to think I'm I look young for someone who's been in nearly 20 years. And I've taught first year students every semester of my career. I've never dodged that. So I've taught probably 45,000 students in my career, 5 different universities. I've taught large classes of up to 800. So it all begins with engagement and connection. Now, if you're teaching intermediate and advanced level, it's a lot different. So most of my advice is really aimed at TAs, young academics, or people who, for whatever reason, will be teaching large units and need to connect with the audience. So it all begins with engagement. So I've always enjoyed pop culture. It's a good way to connect with an audience. And I don't know too much about optics, but in economics, it's abstract, it's theoretical. It's got that reputation as being like the dismal science. So being able to connect with the student through pop culture, through real world applications and everyday life gives him a massive advantage because the material is no longer something that's abstract or theoretical. It can come alive. So the whole point of pop culture is to connect with the audience. So finding the right clip, could be TV, film, music, whatever, viral videos, social media has become a new form of pop culture in the last 5-10 years as well. And just finding the right clip to get the message across to the students. And teaching a lecture is a little bit like driving a manual car. You have different gears. So you've got to break it up because attention spans aren't very long. And the attention spans are getting shorter, probably as we speak, Logan. 5-10 minutes and they're bored, right? So you have an experiment or a demonstration, a bit of pop culture, classroom response system like Kahoot or Think, Pair, Share. Different gears, different ways, different strategies of connecting with an audience. So I find that pop culture is probably the most effective for me. And it's not about me bringing my pop culture into the classroom. I don't play the type of music I listen to. Seinfeld and The Office are two sitcoms that I use that I do personally like, but most of the music I play and the films and the TV shows aren't ones that I know a lot about, and I don't need to. I've just got to do enough research to make sure that when I play it, I can introduce it properly and then play the clip and then use the right type of assessment to ultimately energize the audience. And that's what it's about. That's effectively what it gets down to.
So is it, I think it's extremely admirable and impressive because I assume most listeners have the memory of, you know, your first year or two in college when you're in these extremely large classes and it's just dull as bricks. Like it's
yes,
you don't really know what's going on. It's kind of hard to be engaged, and you get through it. And that tends to be bad for getting people into the field. You know, if your first introduction is, well, it just really sucks and it's boring.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
In German, it's Endstation. Yeah, it's a one stop and that's it. It's all over. I mean, I teach a lot of students at the moment. I'm at UT Austin and micro is a prereq for anyone trying to get into the business school. And that's highly sought after. So demand for microeconomics is off the charts. That's the first economics unit that they do. But that's it. Most of them, that's it. They don't go on to macro, which means they will never become an econ major or minor. My role is to try to, you know, encourage students to undertake that. Now, I've never believed I'm a missionary. My view is not to try to convert people who are agnostic when it comes to economics. If they just want a one semester experience, that's it for them. So you've got to aim the course at the median student. And the median student is not an econ nerd. It's not someone like, you know, Sheldon from Big Bang Theory or you know, Spock from Star Trek, right? The average student is more like Homer Simpson or Penny from Big Bang Theory, actually. So it's got to be pitched at a level where the median student can comprehend and rigorous enough to prepare students for intermediate level. And I've always said to students, listen, if you want to major or minor in econ, I'm here to help, I'm here to advise, but don't expect this to be the normal experience. That most lecturers are more traditional. It's neoclassical theory. It's abstract. It's mathematical and proofs and all that kind of stuff. And that's fine. You need that to succeed in economics. But the first year experience is a lot different. It's about opening your eyes to what economics can do, showing them the economics toolkit. You know, how do we think about the world? What problems can we solve? How do we construct models? How do we interpret data, et cetera, et cetera. Beyond that, though, it gets a lot more rigorous. So enjoy the first year, because if they don't enjoy the first year, they're certainly not coming back for a second.
Right. So I guess tacking along with that, what is, in your opinion, part of the goal of teaching economics, particularly for those first year students? Is it strictly kind of to focus on the idea of here's how you can see the power of economics, or is it further to actually ingrain some of those core economic ideas or theory, et cetera, into their head so they can continue using it?
I think it's both. Plus, I would also add in probably greater financial literacy and to try to hopefully make them better citizens, make them more informed. So encompassing ideas of rationality and decision-making, things that we often take for granted, but which are certainly not taken for granted with 18-year-olds. So I would say both of what you suggest, but also just the need to understand how the economy functions. I mean, it's such an important part of life, even if you don't care much about economics, that the economy influences everybody, from whether you work to what you pay when you buy groceries to whether you save. All those decisions are related to economics and finance. So I think it's imperative. I think economics and financial literacy should be taught more often at high school level. I'm unpleasantly surprised, and you might need to edit this, at the lack of literacy of students about basic things like how budgets work.
So
there's a real need to understand how the economy works and your role in that as a consumer and as a voter and things like that as well. So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different roles that economics plays in first year, but all of what you say is correct, plus the financial literacy, understanding how the economy works, and then ultimately for those who decide to cross over to the dark side, to, you know, prepare them for intermediate level, which is a lot more rigorous and a lot more advanced.
Hmm. Yeah, I we'll get into some of the specific kind of cases that you utilize, but I think I struggled and I thought about this a lot, but I do think the overlap between optics and economics is our catchphrase in optics is optics is everywhere, right?
Economics is everywhere. That's literally it. Is we have economics of everyday life. Is there an optics of everyday life? I mean, yeah, same thing, right?
Right. And I think that was part of what really appealed to me in your use of pop culture is you can point to almost anything theoretically. I mean, pop culture is more easily associated with, particularly for your students, but you can point to it and say, look, here it is in practice, right? And I do think that in optics, we can probably do a better job of that, maybe in pop culture in some ways, but just pointing to real systems that people know and saying, you're learning all this math and it's pretty complicated, but here's the thing, here's the connection. So without further ado, my audience likely are not economics buffs. Yep. But what I really want to try out is to hear some of your examples that you use on your students and to kind of see how that conveys. So to start off with, what does Squid Game teach us about economics?
I had so much fun with Squid Game. So game theory helps us understand how people make decisions in strategic environments. Okay, so there's plenty of applications from poker, the war, to playing chess, which I love, auctions. So game theory is really strategic behavior. Okay, so there's interdependence there between players and games, right? So strategic games are fairly well known by most people. The great thing about Squid Game is that most students struggle, particularly in economics, because remember, we're part of liberal arts. So people from a math, engineering, science background get the math. But a lot of students I have aren't necessarily strong in math, which you might find surprising. Why are you majoring in econ? But a lot of students struggle with the math of game theory. So the benefit of applications like Squid Game is that they show a novel perspective of how people make decisions in strategic environments. So Squid Game is based on a series of six games. They all involve some type of game theory, some kind of interdependence with strategic behavior. So what you're trying to do is optimize your decision in a game where my decision and your decisions are interrelated. So there's plenty of, I wouldn't say real world applications, because the danger with Squid Game, I've given seminars, is people think literally, no, guys, we're not recreating it. No one's dying. There's no red light, green light. Right. The red light, green light is a game played across the world, right? I mean, Squid Game didn't invent it. They just adapted it and just made it more gruesome. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what you're trying to do with game theory is show how people optimize their decision in an environment where there's interdependence, right? So there's strategies that are, I mean, dominant strategy is a strategy that is guaranteed to give you the best payoff. And actually, equilibrium is a situation where neither of us has an incentive to deviate from what we've chose. So you can understand a lot of game theory through practical applications like, you know, chess and auctions and stuff like that. The beauty of Squid Game is that when it was released, it was the most popular Netflix series of all time. It's probably not number one now, but it's probably still top five. Series two is coming out later this year. So you can see how people act in game environments. Now, I would caution to say real world, because it's not technically real world, but it's a practical application, okay? So you can actually see how it works. And when I've given presentations on Squid Game, game theorists have always said, hold on, this is not game theory because they're not following the practical conventions, which is correct, Because in game theory, you know how many players there are, you know your strategies, you know the payoffs involved as well. In Squid Game, they often don't know the rules before they start, and they don't strategize efficiently or rationally, but you can use it as a great teaching moment, because you can say, well, okay, this is how we teach game theory. How do these players deviate from these assumptions in this game? Mm-hmm. So it's a good teaching moment, because you can inform students about what's missing there. Okay. Right. So it doesn't have to rigidly adhere to a normal game theoretic situation to be perfect. Sometimes the imperfection is perfect. It's a bit Orwellian
in that.
And students love that stuff. And they can relate to that, that they've seen it all before. And look, it's good fun. It's gruesome and it's brutal and it's bloody and all that other stuff. But 18, 19-year-olds are pretty desensitized.
Right. It makes them more motivated to pay attention in that lecture. So,
oh, of course. And I mean, one example is, so I'm not sure how familiar you are with Squid Game, but the marbles game. Okay. So the marbles game is where we've got 10 marbles, and each player's got 10 marbles. The winner is the one that gets the marbles from the other person, right? So they play that. Good example of a zero sum game, right? Because only one player can win. Okay. So there's lots of really simple game theory applications from Squid Game. Students love it. But a lot of popularity. We've got a website, Economics of Squid Game. We've got a paper published. And with the series two coming up, who knows? Maybe there'll be a bit more interest in the series. So it's all good fun. Students love it.
Yeah. And for people listening, we'll definitely link to that paper, because you have an excellent paper of how very detailed how you can utilize it to teach different economics ideas.
Okay. I mean, I was just going to say, if you've got one lesson on game theory, then we've got a series of multiple choice questions, which you could create a Kahoot out of and play it in 20 minutes. If you've got two lessons, we've got some more detailed, longer form questions with payoff matrices that take a little bit more time. So whether you've got one lesson or two, you're looked after either way.
Yeah. So one thing that you'll hopefully excuse my naivety here, but one thing that I find interesting in a parallel to engineering is, you had said, you know, Squid Game isn't perfect game theory. They're breaking a lot of the ideals of the theory, but that seems to be true in the real world, right?
The world is not clean. The world is dirty. I mean, economists like to think, like, in this laboratory setting with TAs, we can recreate a natural experiment. I don't really buy that, to be honest. Yeah. So they don't like what we do, because they would prefer, rather than Squid Game, they would rather run an experiment with TAs paid $5 an hour to verify or unverify their assumptions or whatever. Whereas sometimes you get beautiful natural experiments that just are given to us by Hollywood, or in this case, you know, South Korea.
Right.
And yes, it's not perfect. They do violate central tenets of game theory, which tends to annoy purists, but that's fine. Just acknowledge it up front and move on.
Yeah. And I think it's a beautiful opportunity as well for kind of the analogy to engineering and science, which is, in engineering, you need to know when you call something good enough, right? Yep. And it won't be the pure theory in science, but if you're trying to do something, it's good enough. So moving on, you also utilize what I think has to be probably now the dominant pop culture thing when we're recording this. This is in March of 2024, which is Taylor Swift.
Yep.
And I've seen the headline. She's a economic force unto herself. So can you kind of share a little bit about how you utilize Taylor Swift as well for teaching some of these ideas?
Yeah, the Taylor Swift stuff is just off the charts. So it's you know, something's going right when there's a term named after you. So Swiftonomics is basically just the idea that she's an economy unto herself. Like when she tours, there's multiplier effects. So you make lots of money from her tours. So Swiftonomics was first coined, I think, in 2022. The idea stemmed from this was a positive demand shock after COVID. You know, COVID, we're all inside, isolated, not doing anything. Then the doors opened up again. We became happy about life. And people started spending all this money, right? There's a lot of pent-up demand. You couldn't spend much during COVID, right? And then when she announced the Eras Tour, now Swiftonomics often relates to the tour itself. But it's the economic phenomena that is Taylor Swift. So it's incredible. I mean, the tour itself, I mean, she played in my home city, Melbourne, 3 weeks ago, and Melbourne Cricket Ground sold out 96,000 people three nights in a row. And she played in Singapore 2 weeks ago, and I got interviewed by an NPR affiliate because she played in Singapore, but she created and this relates to economics, an exclusive agreement with the Singaporean government to play six concerts in Singapore, but every other Southeast Asian nation got bumped. Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, all pissed. They all got bumped off that. She said, no, exclusive agreement. This is a good example of monopoly, right? So the Singaporean government allegedly paid her $3 million a concert. So they've invested $18 million. Now, Singapore's a really small island. It's about the size of London, right? Population about 5-6 million people. They would have absolutely killed it because an $18 million investment for Taylor Swift to play six concerts, look at the tourism coming in.
Yeah.
And there is a major multiplier effect here. Sometimes the economic analysis of Taylor Swift is overstated. It's exaggerated because the money's diverted. It's not new money. If I go from Austin, Texas to Tucson to see Taylor Swift, we lose money here and we gain money in Tucson. So there's not new money created. But for Singapore, because they were flying in from different countries, it is new money. Right? Mm-hmm. That may have been diverted, but from other economies. So the multiplier effect was huge and it sparked a massive spat between the Southeast Asian nations. So the Singaporean Prime Minister will be off the Christmas card list this year. So just a great example. I mean, everything she does is awesome. I don't speak as a Swiftie. I appreciate her awesomeness. I think she's a terrific role model for females. I'm interested in the economic aspect of it, not so much, you know, the music per se, but more the cultural phenomena. And we can learn a lot about economics. I'll give you one example, Taylor's version. Okay. So she signs a contract in 2005 with Big Machine Records, records just the lazy six albums. And then she decides in 2018, I think I'm going to move to a different company. So then she signs with Universal Music Group. Now, the original company has been acquired by a different firm at this point, and they wanted to re-release her music and obviously make a lot of money out of it, right? And she wasn't given the right to purchase the music back, so she thought, okay, Taylor's version. I'll re-record my old albums. I'll add in some Vault record tracks. I love the way Vault record tracks are added. This is the stuff that doesn't make the original cut, right? And it just gets taken off the floor, right? And then added back in. So Taylor's version's gone off the chart. So what happens now, every time she re-records an old album, the Taylor's version, it goes to the top of all the music charts, the streaming aspect. She makes a lot of money out of it. So it's a good example of creative destruction. Every time a Taylor's version album appears, the old album disappears and then that one goes to the top. Creative destruction is just really innovation and invention of new products replacing obsolete old products, yeah, right? Yeah. So when she re-records a Taylor's version of Red, for example, that goes to the top and the previous version is no longer considered. It becomes an inferior good, the old version. So it's got creative destruction. It's got IP, intellectual property, creating demand. I mean, and a lot of artists do it these days. It's a very common slogan to have five versions of albums. K-pop has had that for a long time. BTS, Blackpink have 5 versions of the same album. Each version is a different color, like with a different sticker or color book. And that's enough to get people to buy the entire album. And Taylor Swift is doing exactly the same thing. I mean, she's a billionaire now. She's going to make estimates from Eras to it. So it's already the biggest selling tour in history, over 1 billion. There's estimates she might make 1.3 billion alone from this tour. Chuck in a few hundred million from the Eras Tour movie and the Taylor's version stuff. She is, to paraphrase Jay-Z. He says, I'm not a businessman. I'm a businessman. Well, right. Just put in woman instead of man. It's the same with Taylor Swift. She is a phenomenon. She's rewriting the rules.
So these ideas aren't, I mean, you know, like putting out Taylor's version, putting out another version, or like you said, including kind of the vault tracks. These aren't new ideas. She didn't invent them, but she's optimized how it's being done to some extent, right?
Correct. I would slightly disagree, only in terms of, I think the idea of re-recording versions because of copyright disputes is sort of new, mm-hmm. But everything else is not. I mean, vault tracks, different color vinyl, different giveaways. Yeah. That's all pretty standard. I guess the big difference is in terms of market power, because of her influence and her reputation, she can make a lot of more money out of this. Unknown artists couldn't do that, right? I mean, someone who's struggling to sell it all couldn't say to their company, well, I'm going to re-record my albums because we're not making enough money from you. But it's very common. A lot of music I like comes from the 70s and 80s, and it's very common for artists to sell their back catalogue to a different company.
Yeah,
Bowie did it before he died. It's pretty common. Seinfeld did it in terms of TV sitcoms a couple of years ago as well. And I know New Order, a band I like, did a similar thing. And the music company that buys the music then wants to re-release it, reissue it to make money. Taylor has effectively muted that by doing it herself. That's the big difference, right? And now fans are, there's countdowns in terms of all these old albums reappearing. I think there's a fair chance other artists are going to try to do it. Remember when she pulled her music from Spotify about 5-6 years ago? And she, almost like a union member, basically said, hey, listen, guys, you're not paying enough royalties here, so I'm doing this for other people as well, right? Even that is a good way in which people with power can help rewrite rules and other benefit, because the way we consume music has changed. In my adolescent period, Logan, you're probably a few years younger than me, it was vinyl, then it was cassette, then it was CD, then it was piracy. Early 90s. Yeah. Piracy was the way to do it. Now it's streaming, right? And vinyl comes back as a bit of a niche good. What she's doing now is rewriting the rule books on how artists control their own intellectual property. That's the big difference between her and other artists. A lot of other artists sell the back catalogs, put the $500 million in the bank, and then put their feet up, never have to work again.
Right. I mentioned this when we first met, but one of my favorite bands is an Australian band called King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. And they do an interesting thing where they release what's called a bootleg version, but it's for public use. And I'm sure there's intricacies there, but a lot of people then go and use their IP and make new things. And like you said, they make new things and profit from it. But at the same time, I assume the band profits, you know, not only in goodwill from the audience, but their name gets spread in a bunch of unique ways that they couldn't otherwise have done. So
there was a late book written by a book written by Alan Krueger, an economist from Princeton, who unfortunately passed away in 2019. And he talked about the fact that music consumption has changed. So why do musicians still tour? I'll tell you why. That's where they make their money. Touring makes more money than sales because people don't buy as much now. And people buy by the, they buy, but they stream and they pay like, 50 cents, $1 a song or something like that. So you don't make a lot of money from music sales, not as much as you used to. 10, 20, 30 years ago, albums. Remember albums? And then there was a single and then another single.
Yeah,
and if you were good, let's have a third single. That doesn't work as much these days. It's much easier now just to record individual tracks. Put them on platforms like Spotify, and then by touring, hopefully you make a bit from merchandise as well, but you don't make as much money from recording music, which is why the Australian band U Talk have a novel approach to try to create a niche market. And a lot of it is based on customer loyalty. Loyalty means people have inelastic demand. that they're not responsive to price changes, and they're more likely to pay a little bit more for something. So you can make a little bit of extra money from them, provided you can obviously grow that market.
Right. And I will say just offhand, it's definitely changed the listening experience. Like you said, I mean, if you're listening to bands kind of around New Order, right, and that period, they're putting out an album, and you kind of would evaluate things from start to finish of, is that a good album? And sure, it had some hits, but is it the album? And now, like you said, oh, well, they put out a good single. And it makes it a little frustrating for me, but because I like to listen to a whole album, but
if you think from a musician's perspective, is it worthwhile to record an album?
Right.
Now, I mean, back 20, 30 years ago, album, single release, tour. And when you had a long tour, then, you know, you get a bit more. Occasionally, you go through the reissue, but the live album was the way to go, or the greatest hits album, right? So live greatest hits are the ways you can reissue without reissuing, right? Mm-hmm. These days, for younger artists, it's probably not worth their while to do that unless you've got significant market power. And because remember, companies aren't paying the same contracts they did 20, 30 years ago because an album meant a lot more, right? So you get a band. I remember the Stone Roses. They had a great first album and then for some reason changed an amazing English sound to an American sound. It didn't suit them. Second album was unfortunately not very good. But the first album sells, you get big contracts, and then you have a second or third. That doesn't happen these days anymore. It's very rare for artists to be given long-term contracts because there's much more hit and miss when it comes to this stuff. Now, the market is a lot more sensitive now to consumer demands and a lot more fickle. I don't think long-term contracts work for companies because I don't think a lot of artists now have staying power.
Yeah, yeah, right. Things, like you said, I mean, I think pop culture is changing along with many other things increasingly quickly. So,
although Taylor's obviously an exception to that rule because... Yes. She's born late 80s, early 30s at the moment, and she's popular with every generation. I went to a pub in Austin a few weeks ago, and a guy who knew a friend of mine was on the table and talking about Taylor Swift, the paper. And he said, I'm part of the 50s for Swifty. So he's a guy in his mid-50s, part of mid-50s, so he's probably in the Gen X category, right? X, Y, Z, millennials, they all seem to love her, right?
Yeah, yeah.
She transcends generations probably the Beatles would be the closest.
I was going to say the Beatles is what jumps to mind for me. So,
because someone like Michael Jackson, I wouldn't have thought, he was very popular in the 80s, never was really popular with 50, 60-year-olds. Whereas the Beatles, because they're the 60s, I think a lot of people listen to them probably still do. Yep.
Right, right. Well, I'm going to change gears. I will link to this paper as well, but you have papers kind of explaining how to utilize Taylor Swift and Swiftonomics. Mr. Beast is another one that you've mentioned, but I want to switch gears to one of your more recent papers, which
ChatGPT,
right? Okay. The other dominant cultural effect. So for everyone that hasn't used it, which I think could be a lot of people and who aren't students, what is ChatGPT and how has that changed the classroom?
Okay. So, I mean, ChatGPT is really just a form of artificial intelligence, so based on natural language models. So the version, the 3.5 version came out, I'm going to say November 2022. We wrote a paper on it 6 weeks later. That was the effect. It was like literally watching, like after a nuclear explosion, the mushroom cloud in terms of the effect. So so basically that was the first, and that's, I think, co-owned by Microsoft. Now, Google bought out Bard, although Bard, I hear, is not very, very good. Now, there's lots of similar models being developed. Effectively, what ChatGPT does is, in terms of educational teaching, it's a little bit like an online Wikipedia on steroids in terms of access to information. Now, the original version 3.5 that we used in our paper was not connected to the internet. Mm-hmm. And it was only trained on data to the end of 2021. So effectively what they do, the engineers, is they feed the system all this information. And then what it does when you prompt it is, on the basis of probabilities, try to guess the answer to what you ask. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the recent version 4.0, which is live, so it's connected to the internet, is obviously a lot better and faster. It's also got more ability to read diagrams. When we looked at a research project in January last year, we asked ChatGPT to take the TUS, the testing of understanding of collegiate economics, and it did very well. it ranked in the 91st percentile with microeconomics and the 99th percentile with macroeconomics, which means it's very, very good. And how it's changed the classroom
Before you go on, sorry, I want to give context there as well. Yep. How did real human students do on that same assessment? I think that's an important.
Oh, okay. That's a very good point. So, So the TUS is typically given after one semester of economics. So there's a macro version and a micro version. So sometimes I forget all the context and just go skipping ahead. A student would typically get about 12 or 13 out of 30 on the micro and macro exams after. It's a multiple choice exam of, I think, 30 questions. So it was able to score, I think, my guesstimate is it was 28 out of 30 for one and 22 out of 30 for the other. Now, that compares to like 13 or 14.
Right.
And at this time, I think it did worse in macro because it wasn't able to read diagrams, the 3.5 version.
Right.
So it's significantly better than a student after one semester, which isn't that surprising. It's a multiple choice exam. Exam guides are available online. Anything available online, it's got a massive advantage in because it can just filter information much faster than the human brain. Okay. So it does well in standardized tests. And by the time we published our working paper, like only about 3 weeks after it came out, there'd already been pilot studies in science, engineering, math, name your discipline, it's all there. And we get 3 or 4 citations a week now. It's changed the landscape of education. It's what it's effectively done now is enable students to learn at a much faster rate. So there are huge implications for the classroom. We would expect ChatGPT, which is just a chatbot, to do well on standardized tests. The real issue for educators now is how we change the educational framework to deal with this. I mean, it's not like the calculator or the internet, which didn't fundamentally change education. They just made learning more efficient. The calculator doesn't replace learning. It just makes you count faster. The internet just allows you to get information faster. What this does, though, is allow you to create new content, right? Yeah. And do something without doing the work. Effectively, now you can give it a prompt and it'll write an essay. Now, you could do that with contract cheating or Coursera or Chegg, but you've got to pay, right? With the 3.5 version, it's still free, excluding opportunity cost. But, I mean, you could write an essay now by giving it a prompt, and in 1 minute, it could give you a 2,000-word essay. So that's a big difference.
And it's novel, right? It's not, I think that's important for audience members. So a few things pop out. It's obviously ripe for abuse in the sense of, oh, I have a homework assignment. I don't want to write it. I'll just ChatGPT it, and it's done. I think for people who haven't used it, you might think, well, you know, there's plagiarism catching tools. But ChatGPT creates original things. So, you know, there's places where it might fall through the cracks there, but it otherwise will be indistinguishable from, this is new.
That's a very good point. If you go to Wikipedia, 5 years ago, you went to Wikipedia and you just cut and paste. Oh, allegedly, of course.
Right.
And then you make that your homework. If you're smart, you change a few words and make it seem like it's your own writing. Now it could simply be, okay, so, What policy measures did John Maynard Keynes propose to alleviate the suffering in the Great Depression? And literally in half a minute, it'll give you an entire essay. Yeah. And you can say, okay, make it longer, make it shorter. Can you change the prose and make a little bit more active voice? You can give it prompts and then it will just refine the answer. The big difference is 5 years ago, you would search that online. You'd have to still do a bit of work. Now you don't really need to. And as you say, because it generates an original answer, it's very hard for plagiarism software to detect. But the analogy I draw is the engineers who create ChatGPT, OpenAI in this case, are the dopers in Tour de France.
Yeah.
And the administrators trying to stop them are basically the education authorities trying to, yeah, exactly, you get it. Okay, so the person injecting the drugs has an advantage because they know what they're taking, and it takes a while for the test to catch up to the types of drugs people are taking. So, I mean, I guess the extension would be, so what do you do? Do you have a, just say, okay, let everyone cheat and just stop testing and accept that ChatGPT is going to be used and say, well, okay, you can use it and we're not going to monitor it and we'll just grade your essay on who actually has the best essay. The problem there is that someone could literally be doing half a minute of work.
Yeah. Well, and they wouldn't be getting the knowledge, right? They wouldn't be learning exactly the core ideas. So I think there's another important caveat here, which is ChatGPT, it operates kind of on a, you explained this, but it operates on the probability of the next word when it's writing these prompts, which does not mean that it spits out factual information. It spits out things that fit its algorithm.
Yeah, and exactly true.
And so I guess there's two things here, but which I want to address. But the first one is, I think you took an approach that I really loved. I mean, I'm out of the university now, but I think that this is great. Can you explain what how you use ChatGPT to make something for your students that fosters them having to know the actual content?
Well, the easiest way, although it's not easy, the best way, the optimal way to get around ChatGPT is to redesign the curriculum to make experiential learning more important. Anything that involves multiple choice, short answer stuff, it's easy for the chat. I mean, exactly, right? So you've got a couple of options as an educator. If you want to use exams or writing assignments, one option is to bring them in the classroom, paper-based. But again, you need resources. You need TAs, you need graders, you need rooms and that kind of stuff, right? That's a lot of work.
So that you can see you're not using, exactly, you're not using it, right?
Pen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paper. Yeah. And I use that because I've got first year, I've got 800 students first year. And during COVID, they had online exams, absolute debacle because they're all cheating. So if you've got large classes first year, you just bring the exams back into the classroom, you use paper. A better way of beating ChatGPT, especially for smaller advanced level units, is just engage experiential learning. It could be assessment based on a couple of examples in my classroom is getting students to make video projects about economics. So they could find a media and then they could basically create a 3 or 4 minute video on something they saw when they were shopping or, you know, at a football game or something like that. You could also use the natural economist where you pose a question about everyday life and then in 250 words write an essay which has a series of possible answers to it, no math, no abstraction, no graph, so they've just got to write. Those options can work. Case studies, storytelling. There's other ways of assessing students that actually involve them having to create something unique. That's the key thing, create something unique. Because mm-hmm. if it's just formulaic, it's just too easy for them just, and the temptation is there. I mean, I suspect a majority of my students are already using ChatGPT. Already.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's here to stay. So to me, it's a little bit like the Manhattan Project. Once you go down that path, there ain't any going back. We have to learn to live with it. We've got to be mature and responsible about it. The world's not going to fall in. The sky's not falling in tomorrow because people are using ChatGPT. People thought the same thing when the internet came around 30 years ago. So let's embrace it here and redesign our curriculum, redesign our assessment to be mature about this. And I mean, again, I use it in my classroom as well. Like when I create Think Pair Shares, I think Pair Share is a question where the student will discuss with their neighbor, and then they'll share it with someone else. 1, 2, 4, and then they'll have an answer and then they submit. So I create a series of questions with mistakes. And I say, okay, ChatGPT, write something about Adam Smith's invisible hand, create 3 factual errors. And then I'll show it to the students, here's your Think Pair Share, what are the errors? So I've deliberately designed this and it's wrong, you fix it. So you can do it like that. You can also get students to maybe create a proposal using ChatGPT or a draft of an essay and then say, well, okay, here's the draft of your essay. What I want you to do now is identify the errors and fix it up. And you could give them an hour or two to work on inside the classroom. So you can do things like that. The key thing here is embrace it. Why not use it also as a teaching aid? Why do I need to define what a price ceiling is? I mean, if a student doesn't get it, surely ChatGPT does a better job if they don't understand my explanation, right? Mm-hmm. What are some practical examples of price ceilings in the real world? And then it will say, rent control in New York City. Students get that. Price gouging laws with concerts, they get that. So you can use it as a teaching aid too.
Yeah, and I one thing that I find particularly useful is giving them that example of here, there's an error in it and you have to find it. Because the tool's only as good as you are, I suppose, yep. Right? And ideally, this is something you mentioned in the beginning, that part of the goal of teaching these first-year economics students, but really any student, I think this applies, is that they get it, is that they learn the idea and they can apply it in situations where they need to. And if they just chat GPT it and get something wrong, but they don't know, then it's not particularly useful.
Students don't have much of a filter, and they also suffer from recency bias. Pre-ChatGPT, they go on to Wikipedia, and they will just accept that as fact. Right? They don't have that maturity and that wisdom of sitting down saying, okay, well, maybe there's a different side to this story. They just want an easy answer. So you're right, showing them how to use it properly. And the reality is, I think primary school, I think you say elementary over here, we say primary in Australia, elementary school teachers have an enormous responsibility now to help train students how to use this properly, which means the government's got to train the educators because, you know, elementary school, high school, they're stressed out. They're probably underpaid at most schools. It's tough. And the easiest thing in the world for them to do is just say, here's your laptop, go away.
Yeah,
and just let kids do it by themselves. And the reality is that, remember, ChatGPT is fundamentally, in certain cases, replacing learning. My biggest concern is that students won't know how to read properly, won't know how to count, won't know how to write. I mean, they struggle now. A lot of students struggle now because the education in America is not great at certain schools. And also through COVID, lack of social cohesion, a lot of students have picked up lots of mental illnesses, anxiety, and things like that as well. So my fundamental concern is that the kids today won't learn the basics that we learned 20 or 30 years ago at all. And that they will literally just go there to get information rather than actually learn how to use it, synthesize it. What about critical thought? What about analytical skills? I mean, these are really, really important things. I mean, you can use ChatGPT certainly to help with math skills, to improve the way you solve proofs. But if you don't know how anything works, then it doesn't necessarily help you too much.
Right, right. You're not an important part of that cycle, I guess, right? If you're not the one that's kind of curating it and using it for something. So I think that's interesting. And I'm sure it's having similar impacts in basically anywhere in education.
One thing to bear in mind, I gave a talk last year on it at a conference, and Italy had just banned ChatGPT. I thought that's completely pointless. It's like you're not in a bubble or a cocoon. It's not like they can close there. I mean, well, they could set up a firewall and block the internet coming in from outside, but it's a silly response. We've got to be mature about this. Hysterical reactions like that, they're good clickbait media, right? If you know to sell stuff on social media, but it's not a mature response. It's here to stay. We've got to learn how to use it. And educators have a responsibility to train students how to use this as well, but maybe parents too. Mm-hmm. The reality is, I mean, ChatGPT can do lots of awesome stuff. Artificial intelligence can, you know, help people diagnose medicinal problems much faster than the human eye. It can help you write a reference. I haven't done it yet. I'm thinking about it because I'm getting a lot of reference requests. I'm going to do it at some point. Now, okay. Let's see how you go, ChatGPT. Tell me a little bit about John. Feed the resume in and say, okay, then give me a 200-word awesome CV about this guy.
Yeah.
Resume. Because it'd be great because I'm doing a lot of work there. So it can save a lot of work. A lot of white-collar work, responding to emails, organizing calendars. This stuff doesn't have to be done by humans. I personally haven't used it yet, but I know a lot of academics who do, and they rave about it.
I do know one interesting use case that I never thought about was an academic that I knew who's not a native English speaker. It revolutionized their correspondence because what they said is that traditionally through email, they would type out what they had to say, send it to Google Translate and get this very rigid, literal translation.
Oh, yeah.
And you could tell it, but I always found it endearing that you would read the email and say, oh, okay, yeah, I get what you mean, and it sounds kind of funny, but that's nice.
So what they could do now, they could take their phone, you know, with the Google Translate, and you speak into it now, and it puts it in English. They could do that, although you can't really, or they could record the email. But that would be pretty cool for a course announcement. You could have some broken English, and then all of a sudden it's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, and they're now tossing it in ChatGPT and getting a very natural, I mean, I guess as you'd expect, but a very natural sounding.
Yeah. You can tell business tone, casual tone, friendly, known for 20 years. Let's do some colloquialisms. You can give it different prompts. I mean, I don't need to as a native English speaker, but I know when I write German, I get a little bit nervous at times because it's not as good as it should be. haven't used it yet, but that's something I'd certainly consider. Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyways. So I guess that kind of covers the main domains of what I wanted to discuss, and we'll put links up to these papers. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask a bit of freewheeling questions.
Oh, absolutely. As you can tell, the audience is still here. I freewheel anyway. I can't follow scripts very well. Well, you probably worked that out when we read a beer a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, perfect. It works out because I'm the same way. So I guess the first thing on my mind is you have a shirt on for one of the best sci-fi movies of all time, in my opinion. And I'd love to hear what are the top three sci-fi movies you recommend for someone to watch?
I'm not a sci-fi connoisseur. I mean, Metropolis, the crossover here is I'm a massive fan of Weimar cinema. So, the Third Reich is my main period of study in German history. And obviously, Fritz Lang's Metropolis comes just before that. I think it's a powerful film, and it's a silent film too. I mean, it's amazing. The cinematography is off the charts. I don't watch a lot of sci-fi films. My favorite film is actually Clockwork Orange. I'm not sure that would be sci-fi, but certainly futuristic in certain ways, right? The metaphors and analogies from Clockwork Orange from early 70s still apply today, right? The whole idea that man is born like an organic fruit, and over time we try to kill the criminal instinct, that type of stuff, and mechanize human nature, and it doesn't work, right? So I like films that have overarching sort of universal themes. Mm-hmm.
One of my coworkers prompted me the other day asking if I knew what the core concept was in Kubrick films. And I had a lot of ideas, but he said, in his opinion, what he thought is it's man's tendency for evil, basically, that across most of the films, there's this consistent theme of like an inherent evilness in man. So let me ask a different question. Then you said that New Order is one of your favorite bands.
Yep.
What are some other bands from that? I would kind of call it New Age, but maybe that's not totally fair, but from that era that you recommend. One of them that I love is Roxy Music.
I definitely like, okay, so punk, so pretty much from 76 onwards, so Sex Pistols, Clash, in terms of American punk, Ramones, Damned, I mean, certainly the first wave of punk. I find New Wave even better, because New Wave, which is the wave after that, which is basically inspired by punk, but not necessarily, they don't look punk. And obviously, mm-hmm. Roxy Music would be part of that as well. A little bit of David Bowie, but love Joy Division, New Order, and then Cure, Smiths, all that type of stuff. And New Wave music has never left us. I mean, bands I listen to today, The Shins, The Decemberists, The Killers, Interpol, are still heavily influenced by that music. So I can stay up to date with music. And that's the other benefit of Spotify, right? In terms of, it's never been easier to get into new music. I've often thought that if I meet someone who doesn't like music, I will walk away from that conversation. I don't consider myself a snob. I'm very open-minded about anything in life. But if someone doesn't like music, I reckon I'd walk away. They said, no, I don't listen to anything at all. The good thing about music is everyone loves it. It doesn't matter what genre it is. You can have playful discussions. You can have robust arguments. Which genre is better? Blah blah. Which album is better for a particular artist? Everybody loves music. I mean, music is just the most awesome thing ever created, because it's personal. Everyone's got a song that means something to them, you know. But I love music. Downtime, I always listen to music. Always. Yeah. One comment just to go back to Kubrick. He said, I think he focused on man's propensity for evil. Okay, now, Clockwork Orange is based on the book by Anthony Burgess. Now, here's the thing. In Kubrick's film, have you seen Clockwork Orange?
Yeah, yes, I have.
Okay.
I recently rewatched it and was reminded of its insanity.
Kubrick did something which is very different to Burgess. The original book has 21 chapters, and in the final chapter, Alex, the wanton, depraved juvenile delinquent, in the final chapter, he's grown up, he's matured, he's got a partner, and he's got a kid. Now, Kubrick didn't like that, because what you said, it did. He said, this will never work with Americans. This will never work. The Americans wanted the Old Testament ending, at the end, where he's in heaven and, all that. He's in heaven, but he's engaging himself in all these wonderful fantasies. So he actually removed the final chapter of the book for the film.
So have you seen The Shining as well?
Yes, great film. Yeah.
So a similar deviation in the sense that the book is very much so driven by this idea that there are like literal evil spirits or an evil spirit in the hotel. And the movie, at least my interpretation, is it's the insanity and badness of of the characters and not some superstitious thing. I don't know. It's interesting. I love Kubrick movies, but they definitely have a certain bend to them. So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, obviously I've seen Shining, Space Odyssey. I think everybody's seen that. A couple of the films I know of, but haven't watched, but Clockwork Orange. But I mean, I got into that originally from the book. Absolutely. Right. So the Kubrick connection. And I was fascinated by that because the ending is a lot different. Burgess, his view was we're all capable of redemption. So going back to that orange metaphor, the orange is a natural creation. And when we try to mechanize that, that's the clockwork part of it. Things go awry. And sometimes you can't fit a square peg in a round hole. So I guess Burgess is saying, don't do that. Yeah. Sure, people may fall off the wagon, they may fall off the rails and do bad things in life. But if you give people enough time, maybe there's chance for redemption. Whereas Kubrick seems to have a bit more of the Old Testament view of the
end. Yeah, right. Like you said, very New Testament versus Old Testament. So here's kind of a personal curiosity question. What do you consider good intro media for people looking to delve into history? And I let me preface this a little bit more deeply. My experience, and I think the experience of a lot of my peers in, like you said, primary education or secondary education, is that it's really boring. It starts out pretty interesting, and then you hear the same thing a whole bunch. And by the time you get to whatever age, I've heard it a ton of times, I don't want to study history. But sometimes you strike upon some unique thing, whether it's podcast or book, and man, it's amazing. So what do you recommend?
Oh, I'm actually listening to the Rest Is History podcast now. I think it's about 440 episodes. I started at one. I've reached 203. I'm actually in the Civil War at the moment. So don't tell me what happens. So I'm halfway through at the moment. And it's fascinating because each podcast starts with a story. There's lots of good anecdotes. And so occasionally they're bringing historians who've written books and things like that to talk about specialist topics. And it pretty much covers the whole gamut from ancient to modern to medieval. It's got Western, it's got non-Western. So the Rest Is History podcast, I would certainly, definitely, recommend. It's been so long since I taught history. If I went back and taught history, and I'd love to teach history before I retire, I would love to recreate elements of history. So if I was teaching World War One, I would like the students to actually recreate the battles without the blood and gore, of course. So I think that's the best way you learn. I think learning by doing, immersion is the way to do it. Just reading and memorizing names and facts and numbers and dates is pretty boring stuff, to be honest. So I think you've got to immerse students in history. So at elementary, high school level, activities for students, it's got to be more than just, you know, listening to boring white men talk about history, because that's not interesting to a lot of young people. But history influences us. You know, there's lots of quotes about, you know, if you don't learn from history, you repeat the mistakes, all that type of stuff, which we know, we understand. History shapes our lives, but we fundamentally are detached from a lot of our own history. So I think the best way to do it is to immerse students in the activities that actually shaped history. Now, I don't have a compendium available yet because I haven't taught history in over 25 years, but I'd love to do that before I retire. I would love to go back and teach history for a couple of years, maybe at a high school or community college, not maybe even do it volunteer work, because I don't really at that stage won't need the money, just do it for the love of history, because I think it's important that we understand, but also understand more than our own history. I think it's important local and also national, but also global. My view is don't force students to learn it. I mean, if you force them and say, well, you must do that, then they think, well, I don't really want to. So let people choose the history they want to learn and then try to immerse them in it. But also, history should be about viewpoints, not necessarily right or wrong, black or white. A lot of history is great.
Yeah, it can help teach nuance. And I think that's something dearly lacking, right, in a lot of discourses, particularly for historical events. It's, oh, that was bad, but without much contextualization around the event.
It's all based on context. I mean, I was listening to the Australian they had the Australian History podcast when Captain Cook discovered Australia. Apparently, no one lived there. So the Brits claim no one lived there, right? It was empty land.
Right.
It wasn't. But I think it's unfair to look at what Cook did in the 1780s and say, oh, that was bad because it's bad now. In those days, it wasn't really considered bad. And what we would consider abhorrent today wasn't abhorrent back then. So it's not fair to judge people by laws, you know, 230 years after they did certain things. I mean, in a certain extent, you've got to contextualize it by looking at what was considered normal at that time. Now, you can still look at it through a critical lens, but being cut and dry about it is a little bit harsh. And these people can't defend themselves, right? They've been dead for 200 years.
Well, I think it can convey as well kind of the important thing that I've experienced anyways from traveling a bunch, which is maybe certainly, you know, maybe not in that scenario, but you get different perspectives and you see or you hear about totally different approaches to living life or to setup of society, whatever, right?
Yep.
One of my favorite books, I have to plug this, so I apologize, but one of my favorite historical books is West with the Night about Beryl Markham.
West with the Night.
Yeah, it's a autobiography about this woman who grew up in, I'm going to forget where in Africa, but grew up in Africa and ended up being one of the first people or women to fly east to west across the Atlantic. And one of the biggest takeaways I had is the way that she writes, coupled with the events that she lived through, it's just stunning, right? She did things that are unbelievable, but writes about them as if it's like, yeah, I just did them. And yeah, I don't know. It gives a different perspective on life.
The point you make about traveling, I'll say this briefly.
Please.
Over time, is that the advice I give to students is travel when you can. It's common in Australia when you finish high school to take a year off before you do university, a gap year, sometimes two years, because we can get visas to England. They go for a year to work and then a year to travel. It's not as common in America because the college dream is you know, paramount from an early age and parents are worried kids will miss out or fall behind. But seeing the world is a humbling experience. I've been to like nearly 50 countries and I'm not arrogant about my own country. Well, we sport occasionally, but that's a good friendly arrogance when it comes to sport, right? But not arrogant about my country because I realize that there's things we do well, things we don't do well. And when you travel and meet people, you actually learn a lot about life and culture. Mm-hmm. More people should do it.
So you actually touched upon, we're getting close to the time. I don't want to take too much of your time, but the last thing that I really want to cover is, what recommendations do you have for two groups of people, actually? One for students, how do you think that they can kind of, I would say, lead a more successful and fulfilling life? And then separately, you've mostly covered it in what we've discussed today, but additionally for educators, how can they lead a more successful and enjoyable life as an educator?
That's a tough question to end on. I mean, in terms of students, my advice has always been do something you love, do something that is passionate for you, because life is too short to waste time on stuff that you don't like or don't find interesting, especially if you struggle. I mean, you might do stuff because you think you'll be successful and you might be good enough just to go through the motions and get it done. Most students, though, when they study subjects or courses they're not very good at or don't like, they struggle. So always start with something that you're passionate and enthusiastic about. And if it's vocational as well, happy times. You've got that beautiful Venn diagram where everything's overlapping, right? But if you've got to choose between that, I would choose something that you're passionate, enthusiastic about. Now, I studied history and thought, well, okay, I wasted 5 years, right, because I taught economics instead. But I haven't wasted it. I still listen to history podcasts now. I teach an economic thought course which looks at history, Keynes and Marx and Marshall, old historian Smith. So I'm still tapping into that passion. Always chase your dreams in life, do something you're passionate about, and then go 100%. That's the basic advice I give to students. It goes back to economics. I mean, do it your best and trade for the rest, right? You can be a jack of all trades, master of none. Don't do that. Focus on what you're best at, what you're most passionate at, and then education is never wasted. I always say, listen, you know, stuff I did 10, 15, 20 years ago, I still occasionally use. So you're going to make mistakes in life. Don't be too hard on yourself. At 18, 19, you're too young to probably work out what you want to do for the rest of your life. So don't worry about that. Just go short, medium term. Have long-term goals in mind, but just inch along the way. Sometimes you go the wrong path, you circle back, and then you take a new path. So there's a lot of messages there. Do what you love, do what you're passionate about. Don't try to be everything to everyone. Follow your heart, follow your dreams. In terms of educators, look, be true to yourself. We've all got different styles of teaching. Learn a little bit about pedagogy, learn a bit about how people like to learn and learning strategies, but ultimately go with your instinct. Work hard, be prepared, but don't make learning boring. Try, if you've got an extroverted personality like myself, it's easier because I'm all over the shop anyway. But learning's got to be about fun. As much as it's about acquiring details and knowledge and getting good grades and outcomes, learning's got to be fun. Focus on the process of learning and then have fun. And if you do that and you're true to yourself, you probably have a good career. The other thing is if you're a young educator, be open-minded, be willing to try new things, be willing to accept constructive criticism. No one does things perfectly. I'm okay with people saying, Wayne, we didn't like what you did. You can do it better. That's fine. That's all part of the game. Don't be too headstrong about what you do. And you've got to be willing to listen to other people as well. And ultimately, if you're an educator, be like Homer Simpson. Show up energetic, enthusiastic, and passionate. Because if you don't care, why the hell should the audience care?
Yeah.
You know, I've survived 20 years in this game. I may get another 5-10 years later. And we'll see how we go. But the morning I wake up and think, nah, I've got no passion, I'll walk away. I don't know what I'm going to walk away to. It might be a chessboard. Don't know. It might be traveling around the world. I don't know. But always do what you love in life and, you know, do what you do best and hope that everything works out.
Well, perfect. My guest this week has been Wayne Geerling. Wayne, thanks so much.
Absolute pleasure. I'll let you know when I'm back in Tucson. I normally like to visit every year or so, so I'll come back and catch up.
Yeah, let me
what's
know.
Good Oak? What's that place called?
Good Oak. Yeah, let me know when you're back and we'll get
it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Spotlight Report. As always, we invite you to go to our website, community.eleoptics.com, where you can communicate and discuss this episode of the podcast and find all other episodes of the podcast, as well as other useful information. Thanks. Have a great day.